130 docket. First case is People versus Toby Martinez. Counsel are present, prepared to proceed. Second case is Belvedere Tower Condominium Association versus American Com. Our counsel president prepared to proceed?
Yes, you are.
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much. Now, I believe when you came into court today, you received a set of written instructions about our oral argument procedures. Do you have any questions about that?
No, Your Honor.
Questions about that?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. I'd remind you, when you come to the podium, please identify yourself by name and registration number. And I'd ask that everyone in the audience turn off their pagers and cell phones so as not to interrupt or obstruct, interfere with oral arguments in the cases. With that, we'll begin to hear arguments in People versus Martinez.
May it please the court, my name is Rachel Cohen and my registration number is 36907. I represent Toby Martinez. Mr. Martinez is a man convicted mainly on his past. There was an intricate connection between admission of former act evidence at pretrial hearings and then following into trial and denial of defense motions for challenges for cause at jury selection. From pretrial to jury selection to trial, the district court erred in its decisions to admit such prejudicial evidence and to deny defense motions at voir dire, while the prosecutor flagrantly ignored her own promises to limit the scope of her questioning. The end result is that the prejudicial evidence was wrongly admitted and Mr. Martinez was denied a fair trial by a fair tribunal of his choice. First, the district court permitted 404B evidence that did not have sufficient relevance. The age of the victims, the length of time over which the acts occurred, the recantation by TC in this case and not by RM in the former case. All of these facts are markedly different and changed the type and nature of the cases from each other. Furthermore, there were 13 years separating those cases. Second, the process.
I thought there were 11 years, counsel.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
I thought there were 11 years separating the two cases or the allegations in the two cases.
The allegations, yes, 13, I believe, was the difference in terms of the time with regards to the actual acts that were in question.
Well, I thought it was the actual acts was 11 years between the incident involving RM and then those involved in the present case.
I may have that incorrect, Your Honor. I'm sorry.
Okay, I'm sorry to distract you, counsel.
That's okay.
Does it make any difference, counsel, that for those years he was in custody?
I think that even with consideration of those 4 years of being in custody, which would be obviously something out of his hands and would probably be taken off from the time, I think it's still such a substantial time difference. And the remaining facts are so different between the cases, especially the age of the child victims and the recantation really, really put the cases at odds with each other. They're very distinct.
Do you have any authority indicating that a recantation in one case makes a case distinguishable such that evidence of other bad acts could not be admitted?
No, but I think that, first of all, I really, in my research, didn't find a great deal of recantation cases that really were on point to this. I do think that this case is very different from any of the cases that were cited by the prosecutor in pretrial hearings. All of those cases that were cited to try to show similarity were ones where distance and times were explained by familial changes. The acts were really distinctively similar. The various outlined requirements of Spoto and Janes just weren't met in this case in the same way as those other cases. And the recantation sort of throws a hitch to it because it's impossible to ensure the reliability in this situation. The district court even noted that the recantation came, quickly, that under the circumstances, also they noted the original child hearsay witness really was not trustworthy as a witness, couldn't be called with regards to that child hearsay because of the absolute tumultuous nature of the relationship when these allegations allegedly came out and the circumstances that they came out in.
Ms. Cohen, do you have any authority for the proposition that the 404B evidence could not come in because of the difference in the ages of the victims?
I believe I think what I would cite is that the similarities of acts that are in James would include similarity with regards to age of victims. And you see in other cases, Snyder was the same victim, so there was a difference in age there, but it was the same victim. Leonard was the same victim. Larson, they were all the same age. Where the courts have found that age is distinctive, it's generally with regards to it's the same age, and therefore the proposition follows the inverse proposition that it's similar.
Why is it an abuse of discretion to admit evidence of a prior sex assault on a six-year-old in the same position as a alleged sexual assault on an 11-year-old? Why is that an abuse of discretion?
First of all, I think she was 12. Secondly, I think that it's not per se an abuse of discretion, but the circumstances in this case make it an abuse of discretion because it wasn't just that the testimony was going to be admitted. It was that there was no real notice of what that testimony was going to be. The prosecutor never actually really did that. They set forth what the original charges were, what the original allegations were. When RM actually made it to testifying, the prosecutor did not do what she said. She didn't tailor her questioning. She didn't tailor the scope.
Was there an objection to that questioning or that scope?
I don't think there could be, because by that time, defense was on notice that this was coming in. RM was extraordinarily volatile. The record does show she was upset by the end of that testimony. It appeared that from the record that she was upset at the start of the testimony. And the things that were related, it wasn't just that she led on with the discussion. She just went through without any stop. No one stopped her. The prosecutor didn't, the court didn't, and the defense
counsel didn't object to it.
Defense counsel, I think, had already, you know, put on the record concerns. And those concerns were allegedly answered by the prosecutor saying, I'm going to tailor this. I think that at a certain point, counsel makes decisions that based on prior rulings. And well, this maybe should have been more vigorously objected to, I think the objections were in place, especially given the assurances by the prosecutor. When RM was discussing her previous memories, I mean, some of these things were not in any of those disclosed packets, including.
Was this the argument in your opening brief that, okay, even if the evidence was admissible, this wasn't because this hadn't been disclosed? Was that the thrust of your opening brief?
I think it was an underlying issue, is that the evidence doesn't follow to have this be relevant. Even if it's relevant, it should have been, it was a concern that it was unclear what was coming out. And then what did come out was so substantially prejudicial.
Well, counsel, isn't that always the problem when you have a victim testify, that they may come up with something that wasn't exactly what was in the disclosure?
This is beyond
what.
And
they may be upset?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. This is beyond what was exactly in the disclosure. I mean, there was a full discussion of background
is this case different from any other case where that happens?
I don't think it is. I think that there is a duty to ensure that there isn't an overly prejudicial prior act evidence admitted to trial. I think that that's the point of the statute. That's the point of the rule, the 404B rule, is that something should not be more prejudicial than probative. That when you have information that's going to affect the whole of the case, that it creates a domino effect because of that error. You need to be particularly cautious. And this court and maybe other courts have not necessarily been particularly cautious when they should have been, and when it was within the power of the prosecutor to bring information before them, whether it was prior to trial opening, whether it was at the pretrial hearings, it should have happened. This testimony was so inflammatory, and on top of it, the prosecutor's remarks at closing, which fully used this information, that it amplified potential for prejudice. A juror couldn't help but be roused to overmastering hostility in this situation. You have discussions of RM being forced to kiss a crucifix while Mr. Martinez called her a good girl. And that was a non-sexual thing. You have explicit discussions of drug and alcohol use, there was objections to that by the defense counsel prior to, with regards to what kind of discussions there were going to be, because she did know about that. Special placements, how many foster homes, how RM had been through many foster homes, and one of her caregivers had died of cancer. I mean, these were things that could have been limited by the prosecutor. These are things that should have been noticed. These are things that should have been kept out. The bare facts, which could have come out with RM potentially, that's not what happened. In this case, we have just severe prejudice. And on top of it, everyone knew this was going to come in. The voir dire, the jury questionnaires discussed it. And we have two jurors who had to be, after the denial for challenge for cause, had to be removed by peremptory challenges, and were directly affected by the kind of information that the defense was worried about in this case, and that should have been cared for. I think if the court had been really, if the district court had been very careful with this, there would have been much less concern about jurors, for instance. I mean, we have juror three who expressed that she had a personal history of child sex abuse, and it was an overlay in her background, and that if she heard information similar, she couldn't keep it out of her mind. And we have juror nine who said she just couldn't separate out her distaste for it and her ability to be fair, you know, from a case, regardless of what the court said. And neither of those statements were rehabilitated. And they were distinct in the sense that the prior questioning, where they said they could be fair, did not require them to really press whether or not their innate bias would be a problem. And it never was rehabilitated after that statement.
Let me ask you a couple of questions about juror three. Isn't it currently the law that in this jurisdiction that simply because someone has been the victim of a crime similar to the one that's the subject of the current case doesn't make them automatically disqualified?
That's true, but I think, just as an example, the recent Schover case, it talks about, can you separate your feelings from the thing? And, well, juror three said, well, I think I can. At the end, at the very end of this time of individual voir dire, she said, well, I really don't know. I don't think, you know, it would be in my mind if I heard similar facts. That's not, can I separate it out? That's not, can I be fair? You know, it's very easy, I think, when you want to be fair. Jurors do want to be fair people, I think, generally.
I thought in your opening brief, you conceded that her assurances would have been adequate, except for the fact that I thought you argued that her personal history made those assurances suspect.
I think they made it suspect, and then I think that in the opening brief, I didn't attach the whole individual voir dire, and at the end of the voir dire, it's apparent that even though she appears to have that, and maybe I didn't make that clear enough, she certainly, at the end, has such clear doubt in her last statement that is not rehabilitated, that regardless of that first setup by the prosecutor in voir dire, I think you lose all of that.
What's the expression of clear doubt? What did she say?
I believe her statement was, and I don't have the exact quote here. I believe the statement was, well, that would be in my mind. I don't know that I could keep that out of my mind if I heard the same facts. Something along those lines. If I might, I'd like to hold off the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel, my name is Catherine Idala, registration number 39218, and I represent the people of the state of Colorado in this matter. I'll start with the 404B issue. I think the trial court's findings are fully supported by the record. This was an abuse of discretion standard, and the trial court made findings that fully support the four prongs of the SPOTO test. The prior act was relevant to intent, grooming, absence of mistake, and to rebut the defense that the victim was lying. I don't think it was too remote. I think there was some discussion of 11 versus 13 years. My recollection was that it was 12, but four of those years the defendant was in prison, and I think there's case law saying that that time isn't to be counted. I think there were substantial similarities of the prior act to the facts of this case. There was a loving father-daughter relationship between both RM and the defendant, and TC in this case and the defendant, where the defendant was the nice parent. The abuse occurred in the home when no one else was around and on a frequent basis for an extended period of time. I think it's also noteworthy that there is case law that similarities aren't required for to show intent, plan, or absence of mistake, which, as I pointed out in my brief, was particularly relevant in this case. And also in sex assault cases, evidence of prior acts is highly relevant, and it's expected that this relevance will outweigh any danger of unfair prejudice. With respect to a limiting instruction, I believe the defense counsel was supposed to alert the trial court as to when the limiting instruction was supposed to be given, and I believe defense counsel forgot to do that until after RM testified. And with respect to any sort of inflammatory closing argument, there was no objection.
What about the inflammatory excess of the evidence that counsel alludes to in her opening argument, as far as the different incidents about drug abuse and alcohol abuse and kissing crosses before or after the incident, things like that?
I don't believe that there was any objection at any point through her testimony, so I think we'd be reviewing that on a plain error basis with respect to anything exceeding the scope of, you know, what was originally agreed upon. But I think, as Judge Terry pointed out, witnesses sometimes say things that, you know, that counsel isn't expecting, and it's incumbent upon defense counsel to object to the extent that that counsel believes that the testimony was going outside the scope. I'll address, if the court has no further questions on that issue, I'll turn to the challenges for cause. I think with respect to juror three, the juror who had a prior incidence of sexual abuse, I think that my understanding from the defendant's opening brief was that he conceded that the record fully supported the trial court's denial of the challenge for cause with respect to that juror. I think the extent of the defendant's argument is asking this court to go beyond or to read something into what that juror was telling the court, and that's simply not this court's function to go behind and make some kind of judgment about her credibility or demeanor. With respect to juror nine, I think her statements at best provide ambiguous support for a challenge for cause. The juror nine, to both the prosecutor and defense counsel, gave numerous assurances that the defendant deserved a fair trial, that just because he committed a crime in the past didn't mean that he did so in this case, and that she didn't have concerns about whether she could be fair or impartial. I think this case is distinguishable from the Merrow case, which I believe was cited by the defense, because I think the juror in that case gave a pretty compelling answer as to how she was biased, and there was no other indication in the record that she could be fair or impartial. This juror gave, I think six or seven statements indicating that she wouldn't hold the defendant in a different light, and the trial court, in assessing this juror's credibility, is entitled to consider all of the juror's statements, and this court needs to give deference to the trial court's resolution of that issue. Now, briefly, I'll just touch on the confession and the child hearsay issue. With respect to the confession, coercive police activity is a necessary predicate to finding that a defendant's confession is involuntary, and I don't think anything in this case approaches a level that the defendant's free will was overcome. As I was preparing for this argument and reading through the defendant's briefs, it seems to me that the defendant's focusing on the issue of custody, but this isn't a Miranda claim. This is an involuntary claim, which is a 14th Amendment claim, and custody is just one of a many host of factors that this court should be considering. And I think the trial court's findings are fully supported by the record that the detective used a conversational, non-confrontational style. There weren't any overt or implied promises or threats. The interview was only 90 minutes. The defendant had prior experience with law enforcement, and I don't believe he was in custody. So I think under the totality of the circumstances, the defendant's confession was voluntary. And then finally, briefly, with respect to the child hearsay, again, this is an abuse of discretion standard, and I think the trial court's findings are fully supported by the record. I disagree that people have ignored the plain record as to this issue. I think I'll just briefly summarize the factors that the trial court relied upon. The statements were made close in time to the initial outcry. The responses were age appropriate. The detective used non-leading and open-ended questions.
Yeah, wait. The trial court made those findings with respect to TC's statements to the detective.
Right.
The trial court didn't make any findings with respect to TC's statements to the mother, did it?
That's correct, because I don't believe that was the subject of the motion.
Well, was it child hearsay?
My review of the record just showed one instance of TC's statements to her mother, and I believe it was used to impeach the mother's trial testimony. So that's not for hearsay.
Let's take a look at that, because they bring in the statements to impeach the mother's statements as to, well, this is what I meant. But the subject is initially raised by the prosecution in direct examination. The prosecution says, or asks the mother, didn't you tell the defendant, she says one thing, you say another thing? And actually, I think it's a little bit more specific as to what the record shows that the quote was from TC. What was the purpose of that question? What was its relevance? And was that a hearsay purpose?
I believe the purpose of the question was to impeach her with that, with the testimony.
So the prosecution asked this question about this statement before mother has ever considered making this statement before? Why would they ask her about making this statement? Why would they ask her initially about making this statement?
You know, I'm not sure, and to be honest, Your Honor, I'm not remembering the exact, I don't want to make representations to you as to the flow of questioning on this particular topic, because I don't remember it specifically, but as I represented in my brief, my understanding was that it was used for impeachment, but I can't recollect this specific exchange. And I think if this court has no further questions, the people would ask that the judgment of conviction be affirmed.
Actually, I do have one question.
Oh, sure.
Thank you. Let's assume that it may have been error for the references to TC's statements to her mother to come in. Would it have been harmless error or not? If it would have been harmless error, why would it have been harmless error?
I mean, assuming it's error, it would certainly be harmless in the scope of this trial. I think, I mean, the only issue that's going to show is to how TC's mother learned about the allegations. I mean, the TC had already, you know, made an outcry to both her father and to the detective in that case. So I think how TC's mother's motivations for, you know, wanting to believe the defendant versus her daughter is really not a crucial issue in this case.
Great, thank you.
Thank you. Just to address the additional concerns with regards to the child hearsay and involuntary confession, I would respectfully disagree that the involuntary confession is not a waiver. Mr. Martinez was absolutely in custody. He was not allowed to leave. There was a door closed. There was an investigator between him and the door. The investigator made statements that were acknowledged, you know, they were apparent by viewing the video of his interview. Officer Bird, used the information of his conviction substantially, You know, in explaining deceptive interviewing at the trial, Officer Byrd explained, you have to keep it toned down and play the card you have. Just because he was nice doesn't mean that it was in a custodial interrogation, doesn't mean that he shouldn't have provided Mr. Martinez with notice of his rights, doesn't mean that
you
this was...
You didn't argue Miranda rights in your brief.
You didn't argue
that he was deprived of his Miranda rights?
No, but I did state the fact that the rights were not advised, and I did state that it was not a volitional confession, that there was repeated attempt to try to be able to deny the accusations by Officer Byrd, and those were repeatedly ignored. And
thank
he used
you, thank
that.
You, Counsel. Your time has expired.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you, Counsel, for your arguments. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.